"Yes, yes," said the king. "I've already determined which of my thanes will receive it."
"Don't count your chickens before," began Queen Signy.
"You mean ducks in this case," said King Bajani. "I hear the land in question is teeming with them."
"It is," said Quintilius. "My understanding is that Tamlock's fleet is nearly to Nova Eberacum," said Queen Signy. "How would you expect us to get our fleet there fast enough to defeat them?"
"My wizards assure me they have a solution to that logistical challenge," said Quintilius.
He moved to put a hand on Mafuta's shoulder, but she leaned away to avoid it. She had her own dignitas to preserve. The three Bifalander wizards in gold robes moved forward and whispered to Bajani and Signy. Mafuta assumed they were telling their monarchs they'd be able to copy the magics once they'd seen them performed, just as Mafuta had learned them from Furcha and Dothan. The three gold wizards withdrew a few paces. They were all women, Mafuta observed. At least, she thought she saw women's faces under their hoods.
"Shall we get on with the contest?" asked Quintilius.
King Bajani didn't reply at first. He looked over the five guards in the Governor-General's retinue, especially Dina and the Parvi. Then he turned round to review 2 dozen of his own warriors crowded behind him on the deck.
"If I'm not going to have the pleasure of testing my army against yours," said the king, "I'd like to be entertained by seeing how your guards fare in combat against an equal number of my warriors."
"With what stakes?" asked Quintilius. "It can't affect the outcome of our competition."
"No, no, merely as a preliminary," said the king. "Fights before the main fight, so to speak."
Quintilius glanced down at Mafuta. She nodded her head almost imperceptibly.
"Very well," he said.
Quintilius addressed his guards.
"Are you willing to show our hosts why Roma's legions deserve respect?"
All five pounded their hearts with their right fists. Dina made an echoing clang when her bronze-plated steel vambrace hit her breastplate.
"Ave, Quintilius! Ave, Imperator!" they shouted.
Quintilius smiled warmly. Someday he hoped he would be the emperor.
"There's not enough room on deck for 5 against 5, said King Bajani. "Shall we do 2 pairs, and then the woman armed like an Athican against one of my warriors in single combat?"
The guard captain signified his assent, and Quintilius approved. King Bajani signalled a pair of his warriors to step forward. His trio of wizards created glowing spheres that made the deck of the flagship as bright as daylight. The first 2 Bifalander warriors were almost as tall as the men from Occident's province. One carried a double-bladed axe, the other a sword. Both held round shields in their offhands. Instead of the 2 tall legionnaires the Bifalanders were expecting, only the guard captain stepped forward, protected by his raised rectangular scutum. Quintilius could practically read the warriors' minds. 2 against 1 would make this easier. They approached to engage the guard captain, but when they were a few dozen paces away, he lowered his shield a few inches, revealing one of the Parvi with a blowgun. 2 quick darts hit exposed skin on upper arms. Soon, both axemen and swordsmen were asleep on the deck. King Bajani clapped his delight as their bodies were removed.
"I'll love it," he said. "They shouldn't have underestimated you."
The guard captain and his Parvi comrade, now sitting on his shoulder, bowed and stepped back, leaving the younger, tall legionnaire and the other Parvi, the first one's wife, to fight King Bajani's next pair of champions. They both knew it wouldn't be as easy this time, without the element of surprise. The king spoke to one of his thanes, then selected an odd-looking pair of warriors. One was of medium height, with long arms carrying 2 spears, with 6 more strapped to his back. The other was a short, wide man with a short sword and a whip on his belt. He held 2 captured Roma scutums, each taller than he was. The shields had spikes in their centres. Quintilius caught Mafuta's eye, and an unspoken concern flashed between them. The Bifalanders had a trick of their own planned, he was sure. The short Bifalander anchored the bottoms of both shields against the deck and inched forward toward the legionnaire and the Parvi. His companion crouched behind him until they were within 10 paces of the Roma guards. Then the crouching Bifalander rose and hurled a spear at the top of the tall legionnaire's scutum. Its point pierced the reinforced wood of the shield, and the Parvi hiding behind it cried out and denigrated the ancestry of the spear thrower. The tall Roma guardsman rushed toward the pair of Bifalanders, hoping to knock over the braced shields and flip the short warrior on his back. Instead, the short warrior allowed his comrade to hold the shields while he stuck his head out near the bottom of the right-hand shield and twisted the end of his whip around the tall legionnaire's exposed ankles. The guardsman fell forward, propelled by his own momentum, and fell on the injured Parvi, pinning her between his body and his scutum. The two Bifaland warriors stepped forward and held both Roma down with their boots and the bottoms of their shields.
"Nicely done," said Quintilius, complimenting the Bifalanders, just as Bajani had admired his men's victory earlier.
He turned to his guard captain.
"Remember that trick with the whip," he told him.
The guard captain just grinned. Other legionnaires would buy him drinks for a month to hear him tell the story. Quintilius assumed he was already figuring out how to work it into future training sessions. The two Bifalanders helped the legionnaire and the Parvi back to their feet. All four shook hands. There were no hard feelings. The Parvi was bleeding from a scratch on her side, and Mafuta signalled to Felix that he should help heal her. Now it was Dina's turn to show her skill at arms. Her success or failure would determine which side had the psychological advantage when Vajani and Quintilius began their contest. The young woman in Athican armour stood eagerly waiting for her Bifalander opponent to appear. Queen Signy, not King Vajani, was making the selection. Dina's eyes went wide inside her helm when a young woman wearing only a loincloth walked out to stand at the other side of the deck. Her body was lithe and strong, and her small breasts were a contrast to the ones on Dina's breastplate. She carried two metal rods in her hands. Each had a leather strap riveted to one end. A coiled rope hung from the wide belt that supported her loincloth.
"Wonderful," shouted Dina. "I love your kit. I've always wanted to fight a bull dancer. I had no idea there was anyone interested in that style in Bifurland."
Her opponent bowed slightly, then stretched up on the balls of her bare feet and spun toward Dina. The near-naked woman was faster than the Roma, whose breastplate, helm and armoured limbs slowed her down. Dina ducked, but the other woman still managed to land blows on the side of Dina's helmet and her right shoulder.
"Get her, Riga!"
shouted one of the women standing behind the queen. Dina turned to keep Riga in front of her. She had her sword and shield up, ready to block as Riga raced across the deck, jumped above the point of the sword, and whacked Dina on the back of the helmet as she descended.
"Ball dancing," thought Dina, as she shook her head to clear. "How wonderful! And my sword substitutes for horns."
Aesthetic admiration for Riga's form aside, Dina knew she'd have to work hard and smart to earn victory. The next time Riga danced in to attack, Dina threw her shield not at where her opponent was, but where she expected her to be. The heavy disc caught Riga in the ribs and knocked her to her knees. Dina closed quickly to end the fight with a stroke using the flat of her blade, but Riga caught her behind the knee with a blow from one of her metal rods. Now, both women were on their knees. But Dina thought she still had the advantage. She leaned her torso against Riga's, the weight of her breastplate pushing Riga backwards. Dina used the vambraces on her forearms to block blows from Riga's rods and keep pushing her over. Riga's back was at a 45-degree angle to the deck, and Dina was confident the bout would soon be over. Riga had a different idea, however. She pulled the coil of rope from her hip and looped it over Dina's neck. The loop tightened as Dina pushed Riga farther down. Dina was gasping while Riga's shoulders were getting nearer and nearer to touching the deck. Without air, Dina was weakening. Acting on reflex and training, she pulled a tab at her right wrist, and a blade snapped out along one edge of her vambrace. Dina cut the ends of the rope Riga was pulling, and was suddenly able to draw in a deep breath. Re-energized, Dina pushed Riga's shoulders all the way to the deck planks, and put the sharp edge of her vambrace against Riga's throat.
"Do you yield?" Dina asked.
"I yield," said Riga.
"Well fought."
"Thank you,"
said Dina, as she stood up and retracted the blade on her vambrace. She helped Riga rise.
"I would have done better not to get so close to you," said Riga.
"You would have done better to remember that shields are distance weapons, not just tools for close defence," said Dina.
"Let me get your mug of mead,"
said Riga, as Dina retrieved her shield and the two women pushed through the crowd behind Bajani and Signy.
I think I'd prefer wine if you have it, said Dina, excitement making her voice loud. It's more Athican. Wine it is, said Riga. You can tell me more about how you made your armor.
Quintilius, Mafuta, Bajani and Signe's eyes tracked the two women as they left. Signe covered her mouth to hide her grin, but the other three didn't bother. Mafuta considered it a major plus that the two former opponents were now on their way to being friends.
Ready? Asked King Bajani.
He waved to a pair of soldiers at a sturdy table and two stools were positioned near the mainmast. The table had a pair of thick pegs coming up from opposite corners.
I am, said Quintilius.
The night was cool, but he still took off his toga and linen tunic, leaving him wearing not much more than Riga. He was pleased to overhear admiring comments from Bifalanders, men and women alike, over his chiseled muscles and smooth chest. He was in excellent shape for a man close to 40, and kept up a diligent daily program of martial conditioning. He removed three rings and gave them to Mafuta for safekeeping, then sat on one of the stools and waited. King Bajani decided he'd take off his robes and shirt as well. The Bifaland monarch wasn't chiseled, precisely. His body looked more like it was formed from clay, with a bit extra daubed on here and there. His back and chest were covered in thick hair. It was hard to tell where his beard ended and his chest hair began. As Felix had reported, the king's forearms were larger than his thighs. They were larger than Quinn's thighs, for that matter. Bajani's biceps bulged when he flexed them as he took the stool across from Quintilius.
How does this work? Asked Quinn.
I'll show you, said Quinn Signe. She looked at his forearms, then her husband's, and took 4 1-inch thick discs of braided horsehair from a servant and put them under Bajani's right elbow. There, that should make it easy for you to clasp hands without twisting your wrist down. Grab hold.
Blast, thought Mafuta. So much for leverage.
Quintilius did. He and the king both shifted to find a firm, comfortable grip.
What are the rules? Asked Quintilius.
Grip the peg with your left hand, said the queen.
Quintilius did.
If you release the peg, you lose. If you lift your elbow, you lose. If you break your grip, you lose.
How do I win? Asked Quinn.
By pinning the back of my wrist to the table, said Bajani.
How do you win? Asked Quintilius with a smile.
By having new land to give to my thanes, said Bajani. I may even keep a farm there for myself.
He tightened his grip. Quintilius did the same.
What if neither one of us can pin the other? Asked Quintilius. What happens then?
It never happens, said Queen Signe. Someone tires eventually.
I hope it's not Quinn, thought Mafuta.
She was pleased to see that even Dina and Riga had come back to watch the contest play out. She wished she had a goblet of wine, or even a mug of mead for herself. Queen Signe held up a gold coin.
I'm going to drop this on the table. When you hear it strike the surface, begin.
Mafuta had done her research. Traditionally, the coin went to the victor. Now, the stakes were a great deal higher. Signe held the coin lightly between her pinched fingers and let it drop. Mafuta was sure she heard 100 spectators inhale as the coin descended. She was one of them. Then the coin struck the table with a muted clunk, and the competition began. Mafuta was most worried about the first 15 seconds. She'd learned that many arm wrestling bouts were decided by an initial surge by one participant that overwhelmed his opponent. She was pleased to see that Quinn was holding his own past that point, and then past half a minute. Quinn's greater leverage of sorts was compensating for Bajani's raw strength. She had advised Quintilius to seek out the best arm wrestlers in the legions and learn their tricks. Quinn had been wise enough to do so, taking half an hour while a boat was located. Travelling by water had made more sense than flying, given the size of their party. Quinn's scouts had found a fisherman willing to rent them his boat for the evening. The legionnaire designated to handle the negotiations said the fisherman had been quite accommodating and pleased with the proposed rent, though the rest of the squad of soldiers with the negotiator may have provided encouragement. Mafuta had watched grizzled veterans from the legions show Quintilius how to twist his wrist, vary his force, and appear to lose, only to redouble his efforts and pin his opponent. She hoped the veteran's quick lessons would be effective. Back at the table, Both Bajani and Quintilius were starting to sweat. It was cool enough that you couldn't see any droplets on their torsos, but their furrowed foreheads were slick with perspiration. Mafuta was pleased she'd given Quinn a mixture of fruit and vegetable juices to drink before the competition. It might help him last longer. She looked away for a moment to observe the queen and the crowd. Every eye was focused on the two straining men. She heard Signy gasp and quickly turned back to the table. Quintilius was forcing Bajani's wrist down toward the table. Already it was halfway there. Bajani was struggling to keep the back of his hand from touching. He looked at Quintilius imploringly. Quinn nodded in a way that made it seem like it was just part of his effort to defeat the Bifalant monarch. Mafuta saw Signy's face brighten as Bajani struggled back. He forced Quinn's arm up and back to vertical, then past vertical. With a tremendous effort and shout, Bajani pressed the back of Quinn's hand into the wood of the tabletop. The gold coin bounced and rattled from the impact. Cheers erupted from the Bifalanders. Queen Signy clapped, and so did a young girl with blonde braids like Signy's, who'd recently taken a spot on the Queen's lap. A daughter, assumed Mafuta. Then the wider implications struck her. Letitia's not going to be happy. Bajani jumped up and embraced Quintilius. Well fought, said the king. Well fought indeed. He pounded Quinn's back. And you, my friend, said Quintilius. Yes, shouted Bajani. The Roma are now our friends. We will get our new lands, half of one of Occident's province's greatest treasures. There was more cheering across the ship. Bifalanders were shaking hands with the guards. Some even went to their knees to hug the Parvi, including the one with the deep scratch Felix had just healed. Others brought drinks to Riga and Dina. A thoughtful woman approached Mafuta with a goblet of wine. The older Roma wizard quickly checked it for poison, found none, and drank three swallows. She was still worried about Letitia's reaction. With help from a few warriors, Bajani climbed up on the table and stomped his foot for attention. Only three quarters of the people on the flagship noticed, but that was enough to lower the noise level so his next words could be heard. Yes, he said. The Roma are now our friends, and that is why our fleet will soon go to Nova Eberacum to engage Tamlock's fleet and ensure the treasure is still Quintilian's to give. The king's announcement earned still more cheers. Bifalanders love a fight, thought Mafuta. This should make Letitia a lot happier. Dawn wasn't far off when the Roma travellers were back in their borrowed boat, heading north up the river. Mafuta and Quintilius spoke softly from their seats, side by side on the middle thwart. Why did you lose on purpose? Asked Mafuta. King Bajani didn't want to lose face in front of his people, said Quinn. He made that plain to me with his expression. I knew he'd make good on supporting us with his fleet if I did. That was a lot to wager on reading someone's face, said Mafuta. What if you were wrong? I wasn't wrong, said Quintilius. What is this chunk of land that's a treasure of Occident's province you're giving away? I want to know how far away I should get when you tell Letitia. She knows my plan, said Quintilius. She even helped me refine it. That's reassuring, said Mafuta. Quinn told her. You gave Insula Longa to the Bifalanders? Only the eastern half, said Quintilius. That part of the Long Island is across the sound from Tamloch, and there are plenty of Tamloch settlers already there. Bajani's thanes will help me clear them out and provide a buffer for us against future Tamloch attacks. Until they are dug in and their harbours become staging areas for future attacks from Bifalan, said Mafuta. That's what I like about you, said Quinn. You always see the bright side. It's not funny, Quinn. I know, said Quintilius. But take an even longer view and consider how valuable a fleet of 500 or 1,000 dragon ships would be when it's time for me to cross the ocean and claim the imperial throne. Oh, said Mafuta, that's different. Chapter 47 Dothan.
Higher,
chirped one small child.
Up, up,
exclaimed the other. Later, said Dothan, it's dark and I want you both to be safe.
You ain't light,
said the first child, pointing at the glowing sphere above Dothan's head.
More light than when we're up to feed the chickens,
said the other.
Shush, children, said the innkeeper.
Planner, Marcher, pipe down and don't annoy the wizard,
said the cook. Dothan smiled. At least he knew the children's names now, that he didn't know which name meant with which child. Come to think of it, he didn't know their mother's names either. Both problems could be addressed easily.
Good ladies, said Dothan, I've enjoyed your cooking and your hospitality, and your children for that matter, but we haven't been formally introduced. If we're going to be exploring an old quarry together close to midnight, the least I could do would be to tell you my name. I'm Dothan.
Wizard, it's funny, said one small child.
He could have said, my name is Dothan, what's yours? Said the second child.
I'm Planner, she's Mercher,
said the first child, who seemed indistinguishable from her sister.
I want to be a soldier, she continued. I want to be a cook, said Mercher.
Both are respected professions, said Dothan, smiling to himself so the girls didn't think they were being patronized.
I'm Coegi, and my wife is Gwest, said the thin, long-haired cook.
The two women had empty, rough-woven bags in each hand, the kind grain was stored in for transport.
The girls can be helpful, said Gwest.
Dimples formed in her cheeks when she smiled.
We're a handful and a half, announced Mercher proudly.
This time, Dothan couldn't keep from smiling. I hope you young ladies are good at collecting blue pebbles, he said. I'm going to need a lot of them.
We are, said Planner. We feed them to the chickens for their gizzards. It makes their eggs extra special.
I'm sure it does, said Dothan. He wondered if that contributed to the taste of Coegi's excellent chicken and egg pie.
You've been to the quarry before? He asked the girls.
Lots of times, said Planner. But not after dark, said Mercher. We're afraid of the monster. It snores, said Planner.
I'm afraid of you falling in the lake, said Gwest.
I wouldn't like that either, said Planner.
Dothan looked down and saw the girl shake her head.
You won't let us fall in the lake, will you, good wizard?
I won't let you fall in the lake or be eaten by a monster, he said. Planner and Mercher smiled at Dothan and squeezed his hands. The two didn't take up much room on his flying disc. The girls and their mothers were quiet for a few minutes as they walked along and skimmed above the gravel road, heading west from the dormant dragon. Dothan saw steep cliffs rising ahead of him. He made his sphere of illumination glow brighter and realized they were more than 200 feet tall, with a wide opening ahead, like someone had cut a wedge out of a pie. I shouldn't snack after bedtime, thought Dothan. Everything reminds me of food.
The quarry is just through that gap, said Mercher. Both our mums won't let us go there by ourselves, said Planner.
Your mothers are wise women, said Dothan. You should aspire to be like them.
What does aspire mean? Asked Planner. I know, said Mercher. It's like a tower, a castle. That's a spire, said Coegi.
I mean you should hope you grow up to be as wise as they are, said Dothan. He was enjoying himself. He hadn't spent time with small children since Sulda and Merry were little. A few minutes later, they were in the gap in the cliff wall. Dothan's glow light seemed brighter, reflecting off the stone walls that ranged in colour from white to dark blue. Dothan was impressed by the way the layers of rock seemed to be folded on top of themselves, like the blankets on a haphazardly made bed. He resolved to return to the quarry in the future for a more detailed inspection. If I live through the upcoming battle, he considered. Soon, the gap opened into a broad, bowl-shaped quarry, with high walls and a lake taking up 2/3 of the bottom. Tens of thousands of stones, from dust to boulders, covered the quarry's floor. It shouldn't take long to gather enough mage stones for his needs, thought Dothan. He lowered his flying disc, and the girls ran off to hug their mothers.
What do you say to forming mother-daughter teams to look for stones? Said Dothan. I'll give each team its own ball of light.
Gwest and Coegi nodded. Dothan could see they didn't want the girls to wander off as their own team. He said, Laha, twice, and made 2 new glowing spheres above the women's heads, keeping the original sphere for himself.
Only gather the stones and pebbles that are blue, said Dothan. The deeper the colour, the better.
The grey and white ones don't have magic in them.
We can do that,
said Planner. She tugged Gwest off to the left.
Here's a sack for your collection,
said Coeggy, tossing one to Dothan as she was pulled to the right by Mercha. Thank you for your help, he said softly. The mother-daughter teams were already too far away to hear him. Dothan modified his glow sphere to shine a bright beam of light on the ground in front of his eyes. He paced forward slowly, bending down to pick up promising blue rocks and pebbles when he saw them. He wondered why the quarry was no longer used for mage stones. He was only familiar with Melin Carrig and three quarries northwest of Brendinas, used by most wizards in Darran's conclave. He'd found his own mage stone in the middle of one of the three more than a quarter of a century ago. The stones he was collecting were small, but seemed of high quality. He'd have to ask Daemon why it had been abandoned. Daemon might know, unless it had happened before his time. Dothan's light touched the edge of the lake, and he smiled. Perhaps part of the quarry filling with water had something to do with it. He walked back and forth in a zigzag pattern between the lake and the gap, until his sack was half full and growing heavy. He made a megaphone of solidified sound and called to his companions. Time to go, he shouted. His words echoed off the quarry's vertical walls. They seemed louder than they should, because everything else around him was quiet, including his new friends. Then he heard Murcha's voice off to the right.
What is it, Mother?
She asked. Dothan left his sack near the gap and ran toward the glowing ball above Coeggy and Mercha. He could hear footsteps that must belong to Plenna and Gwest behind him.
I don't know,
he heard Coeggy answer as he got closer. It doesn't feel like stone. Dothan saw what they were looking at. An odd blue triangle poking out from the floor of the quarry. It was big, nearly 4 inches thick, as tall as his outstretched arm, and as wide at the base as the distance from his fingertips to his elbow. I wouldn't touch that, he said. Coeggy removed her fingers from the triangle and held Mercha back when she reached for it.
Wow,
said Plenna, who had just arrived. She stepped toward the triangle with her hand stretched toward it. Gwest put her arms around her daughter's waist and lifted her up. Plenna's legs still churned below her.
What is it?
Mercha repeated. I don't know, and we don't have time to investigate tonight, said Dothan. Please stand back. I'm going to ensure it's not disturbed until I return. Coeggy and Mercha moved 5 steps away. Both mother-daughter teams stared at Dothan as he created a solid blue sphere of solidified sound around the triangle to protect it from small children and their parents. Did you find lots of stones? He asked.
Lots and lots, said Mercha. I can hardly lift my bag, said Plenna, pointing to it proudly.
Excellent, said Dothan. So did I. Now I have to join the king and the royal army. I have plenty left to do tonight, and these stones will help me to do it. You've all been a big help. Thank you.
Yay!
Shouted the girls. I'm going to put the bags on my flying disc and head back at high speed, said Dothan. Your glow spheres should stay in place for a few more hours to light your way back. I promise I'll return to give you girls a ride high in the air in daylight.
That will be fun,
exclaimed Mercha.
And a wyvern ride,
added Plenna. I'll talk to Aenon and see what can be arranged, said Dothan. He hugged the girls and nodded his thanks to their mothers, then hefted the sacks of stones onto his flying disc, rose up, and flew northeast. Cooking fires should make it easy to spot the army's encampment from the air. Simon and Duke Hyden's staff would be sure to know a good place to establish the gate at this end. Chapter 48 To Athal and Gwynedd.
Hello, my dear, said King Tuathal, when Princess Gwynedd was escorted into his tent.
Her gown and water were soaked, and water from her wet hair dripped down her back. She did not look happy, but she waited until the servant withdrew before sharing her thoughts with the king.
You despicable cross between a skunk and a scorpion, she began. How dare you?
The intensity of Tuathal's harsh gaze closed Gwynedd's mouth momentarily. The king clapped his hands twice, sharply, and Irsa, the dark-haired young wizard Vero had assigned him, entered the tent and looked at Tuathal for instructions.
Privacy sphere, now, for half an hour, said the king. Then get out.
The dark-haired wizard nodded, created a sphere large enough to include most of the tent, and left.
Now feel free to tell me what you think of my nature and ancestry, said Tuathel. It wouldn't do to air such phrases in front of the encampment. Tents have thin walls, you know.
Gwinnett stared at Tuathel and spun around 3 times on the balls of her feet. She could feel her toes squish inside her damp shoes, but took satisfaction from the way drops from her long, wet hair sprayed across the king's fine robes and face. Tuathel wiped his cheeks and forehead with a green, bell-shaped, ermine-trimmed sleeve.
"Everything out of your system now?" he asked in a matter-of-fact tone.
"Not at all," said Gwynedd. "Why did your soldiers have to drop me in the river getting out of my boat? It's undignified, and I'm wet."
"My apologies," said the king. "That wasn't my intent or my instructions, but you have to admit it makes the notion that you were taken hostage easier to believe."
Gwynedd sniffed, then sneezed. Tuathel took advantage of her pause in their exchange and continued talking.
"I understand that your guards tried to fend off my soldiers with swords and spears," he said. "You're lucky the boat tipped over near the shore."
"You're lucky my travelling chests are mostly waterproof," said Gwynedd. "I need a bath and time to change into something more suitable."
"And less soaked," added Tuathel.
"The wizard who made the privacy sphere can heat you some water, but don't keep her too long. I may need her."
"Yes, your majesty," said Gwynedd.
She added an ironic curtsy and took off her coat, dripping more water across the tent's canvas floor.
"Far be it for your future queen to inconvenience you." "Far be it," said Tuathel.
He raised an eyebrow and Gwynedd grimaced. She saw the sand table behind Tuathel and walked closer to inspect it.
"Don't drip on my armies," he said.
"I wouldn't dream of it," Gwynedd replied. She pushed her sleeve back so water wouldn't drip on the sand, and saw the small blocks representing the Tamlock army and the army of Darren on the west bank of the Brynaven. The armies were almost equal in size and composition.
"Too many years of primarily fighting each other," she thought.
"Why would Tuathel and Vero force battle with Darren without overwhelming odds in their favour?" she wondered. Then Gwynedd saw the Bifalander's dragon ships to the south on the river and began to smile. The smile vanished when she took in the Ocadens province legions on the east bank. She frowned at Tuathel. He moved to stand beside her at the sand table.
"It's not like you to fail to account for every contingency," said Gwynedd. "How do you plan to win if the Roma managed to cross the river?" "Remember, my dear," said Tuathel, "you and I can win even if we lose. Not that I intend to."
He reached below the sand table and came back holding a small cloth drawstring bag. He pulled square after square of dark brown, irregular infantry tiles representing warriors from the southern clanlands from the bag and positioned them on the west bank, just downriver from Darren's army.
"Behold Vero's surprise, my future queen," said Tuathel. "The army of Darren will be trapped between Tamlock's army, a horde of barbarian clanlanders, and the Bifalanders on the river."
One eyebrow arched up, and he grinned. Gwynedd felt a cold shiver go down her back.
"I expect Dario's surrender by noon."
"And for your foes to accept your gracious offer to make our son High King of both realms by mid-afternoon?" asked Gwynedd.
"Precisely," said Tuathel.
"What about the Roma?"
"I've arranged a distraction for them," said the king. "They'll be turning around and marching back to Nova Eboracum as soon as they get word of my fleet's movements."
"They're blockading the Roma capital?" asked Gwynedd.
"Supported by the northern clanlands warriors sweeping their way south," said Tuathel.
"You are a devious man. I thought you were waiting to consolidate Tamlock and Darren before taking on Ocadens province."
"Once one stone falls, there's no reason not to encourage an avalanche," said Tuathel.
Gwynedd smiled.
"I admire a man with ambition," she said. "I also like the sound of Gwynedd, Queen of all Orluin."
"Not planning to allow Dario to marry?" asked Tuathel.
"Don't spoil my daydreams," said Gwynedd. "I know Dario must marry, and his wife will be queen. But grant me a moment to enjoy the title without adding an adjective describing my age."
"Yes, Gwynedd, Queen of all Orluin,"
said Tuathal. He gave Gwynedd a mocking bow. She stroked the heavy ring on her left hand that bore the Daran dragon carved into a sapphire and gave him a regal nod.
"When it's over, I'll have Queen Caris eliminated," said Gwynedd. "And her personal wizard, too, if Vero can manage it."
"I assumed you would," said Tuathal. "You won't want either of them stirring up trouble for you back in Brendinas."
"Don't let them put up a statue to her," said Gwynedd. "I'd hate to see it when I left the palace."
"Don't worry," said Tuathal. "If one must be erected, I'll have it placed above her tomb. You're not likely to spend any time there."
"Thank you," said Gwynedd. "Do you have anyone picked out?"
"Picked out for what, my queen-to-be?"
"Dario's bride, of course. I assumed you'd want to marry him to a Tamlock noble's daughter to cement the alliance between the kingdoms."
"Perhaps I'll have him wed the daughter of Quintilius and Letitia, to strengthen the hold I expect to have on the Roma."
"She's only 5, said Gwynedd.
"I didn't think you were in a hurry to be the new old queen."
"I'm not in a hurry, but keeping Dario from marrying for 10 years might be stretching my influence over our son."
"I'm sure suitable candidates can be found when the time is right," said Tuathal.
"And I'm sure the time is right for me to get out of these wet clothes," said Gwynedd. "Do you have your knife?"
She turned her back on Tuathal and waited. He stepped behind her, with his personal blade to her neck and his arm around her waist.
"Don't tempt me," he whispered.
Gwynedd felt his breath on her neck.
"Slash my laces, not my throat," said the princess. "We still need each other."
"Yes, my queen," said Tuathal.
Gwynedd felt her gown's laces part as Tuathal ran his dagger up her back. She'd have a servant relace it after it was cleaned and dried. She shrugged her shoulders, and the gown slid down to the tent's canvas floor. The princess was dressed in the wet linen shift that revealed her figure.
"Are you sure I can't talk you into another exceptional performance to give Dario a younger brother or sister?"
Gwynedd asked.
"I think not," said Tuathal. "Once was enough."
Gwynedd turned to face Tuathal and stretched her body like a cat. She put her hands on his chest, then ran them sensuously down toward his waist and beyond. The king was unaffected. Gwynedd started to kneel in front of him and licked her lips, but Tuathal sheathed his dagger and pushed her away.
"You're embarrassing yourself," he said. "I said it would only happen once."
"Oh, all right," said Gwynedd. "If that's the way it has to be."
"Good," said Tuathal.
"Fine," said Gwynedd.
"I need some tokens to convince Dario you're a hostage, my dear lady," said Tuathal. "A lock of your hair, a ring, like that blue dragon signet you're wearing."
"Not that ring, this one," said Gwynedd,
pointing to a smaller band with interlaced knotwork. "Dario knows Crown Prince Dari, the man he thinks is his father, gave it to me. It will have more sentimental value."
"As you wish," said Tuathal.
He took the ring Gwynedd offered and cut off a larger section of her hair than she appreciated. Gwynedd knew Tuathal had only done it to annoy her, and she wouldn't give him the satisfaction of knowing he'd succeeded. The privacy sphere ended, and they could hear sounds from the encampment again. Irsa, the dark-haired wizard, came back to see if the king wanted the privacy sphere renewed. Tuathal glared at her and left to enter his personal sleeping chamber. She saw the princess shivering in her wet shift.
"Follow me,"
she said to Gwynedd. As Irsa left, she took great care not to let on that she'd seen the dress with split laces puddled on the tent's floor. Chapter 49. Back to Melyn Carrick. Aenon tried to focus when they led Rocky through the nearly deserted streets of Brendinas close to midnight. He followed Fircha as she wended her way from the Passant Tiger, the inn at the other end of the gate they'd just taken, to find the warehouse for the wholesaler who kept Daemon's castle and the academy back in Melyn Carrick supplied with flour, butter and beer. Nud walked beside him, talking softly to Rocky from time to time. Aenon asked Nud a question, keeping his voice low so as not to attract any more attention than Rocky did by his mere presence.
"What's Passant?"
"What?"
asked Nud.
"I think I know what dormant is,"
Einan continued. That's when an animal on a shield is sleeping, like the blue dragon on the tapestry.
Oh, said Nod. I'm surprised you never picked that up in your reading. Passant is when an animal has three legs on the ground and one up, like the dragon on Darren's royal arms. It's usually the right front foot that's raised.
Einan nodded and rubbed his chin as he walked. He looked at Rocky, then at Nod.
I guess that means wyverns can't be passant, then, said Einan.
Why not? Asked Nod. They're animals.
Yes, but they only have 2 feet,
Einan answered.
There are books on heraldry in the library in Melancarrig, said Nod. We could look up the heraldic postures that work for wyverns.
Later, said Einan.
Right, said Nod.
I'm glad you said it so I didn't have to, said Mary, as she caught up to the rest after checking out the titles in bookshop windows along their way. She had a dim glow sphere above her head, but they were relying on light from Furcher's sphere for navigation.
Chi was above and behind the three young people, perched on top of Rocky's head. The Raconette was excitedly taking in all the sights and smells of Brandinus. He turned his own head from side to side, trying to absorb everything at once.
There it is, said Furcher, pointing to a long, low wood frame building on the river.
Serendipity Suppliers, read a sign above the front entrance.
Curious name, said Einan.
Nod smiled.
It's a family joke.
Furcher frowned at her son, but opened the door with a key from her pouch.
Why would Furcher have a key to this particular warehouse? Einan wondered.
Furcher went through the door, and a few moments later, one of 2 wide doors farther down the block opened. Nod rushed ahead to help his mother open the other one, and Einan, Mary, Rocky and Chi used the larger entrance to step into the warehouse. It was filled with crates, barrels, sacks, bottles, jugs and boxes of all shapes and sizes. They cast intriguing shadows in the light from Furcher's glow ball.
The gate's over here, said Furcher, pointing to the left.
No, Mother, you've got it backwards. It's on the right, said Nod.
He moved in that direction and the rest of the party followed.
Sorry, said Furcher. I haven't been here in decades. So long as it's a mistaken memory, not impending senility, teased Nod.
Furcher seemed ready to reply, but thought better of it. The gate was formed by 2 massive old-growth timber uprights, a crossbeam 12 feet above, and a sillbeam running along the floor from upright to upright.
Do you remember the trigger phrase, Mother? Asked Nod. Damon never gave it to me. I think he was afraid I'd leave his protective custody.
I do, said Furcher. You know we only kept you in Melancarrig for your own safety.
Nod grimaced at her and put his hands over his ears. Furcher nodded at Nod, then turned to face the gate and recited 10 clear syllables. Einan could see Merry working to memorize them just as he was. Knowing how to operate a gate from Brandinus to Melancarrig could be useful.
Is it active?
Asked Nod. Furcher turned and spoke.
It is, she said.
Nod lowered his hands and stroked the side of Rocky's neck.
Come on, boy, he said. It's just another gate. You've been through lots of them lately.
The wyvern bent his head and rubbed the side of his scaly jaw against Nud's palm. Chi took advantage of his position to muss Nud's hair. Nod grabbed Chi with his free hand and tossed the Raconette to Einan. Chi squeaked and settled into his usual spot on Einan's shoulder. Now that Einan was more experienced with wizardry, he could detect the subtle channeling of power that marked an active gate.
Someday I'll have to learn how to create them, he considered.
Chi seemed as fascinated by the gate as he had been by the sights and smells of the city. He leaned forward eagerly, ready to transition.
No time like the present, said Furcher.
They stepped through the gate, with Furcher continuing to lead the way. They came out through another blank wall at the end of a wide corridor in Melancarrig's labyrinthine pantries. Nod stepped past his mother with Rocky and Chi behind him until they were in the castle's commodious kitchen. Everyone else followed, taking care to avoid being inadvertently smacked by Rocky's swinging tail.
Do we need to get Rocky outside? Asked Nod.
I'm afraid so, said Einan. He's vital to our plan.
Your plan?
Said Mary, squeezing Einan's hand. Einan looked embarrassed. Mary continued.
Einan, you and Nod and Rocky and Chi should gather small mage stones to powder. You said you knew where to find some.
Mary took a breath.
Furcher and I will find a good spot to start building the wide gate.
I will find a good spot for the gate. I grew up here just like Nud, you know, and Merry will assist me in gate preparations, said Fletcher. She gave Merry a look that reminded the younger wizard of her mother's expression when she needed to tone down her exuberance.
Yes, Fletcher, said Merry.
She smiled at Fletcher, and Fletcher grinned back. Merry reminded Fletcher of herself as a girl, though with a more loving relationship with her father. Would the second plateau above the castle work well? Fletcher asked Nud.
That would be perfect, he replied.
Excellent, said Fletcher. It's best you get flying. The sooner you're back with Magestone dust, the sooner we can pull our surprise and get back to Darren. Will you need to coordinate with Dothan at the other end? Said Einan. I can loan you my ring if you need to connect with him. Fletcher held up her left hand, revealing several small gold rings. Dothan and I have a connection in place already, she said. Get moving and watch out for basilisks.
Yes, mother,
said Nud, in a voice more like his childhood self than his current adult status. Einan laughed and guided Rocky toward the kitchen wall that led to the banquet hall and the outside world. He climbed on one side of Rocky's back and fastened his new leather harness. Nud did the same on the other side. Chi moved from Einan's shoulder to Rocky's neck and held on. With a gesture, Einan crafted a tasty magical sphere against the wall, and Rocky launched himself forward to reach it. They transitioned into the banquet hall. Solidified sound constructs opened the outer doors of the hall, and soon the four of them were flying northwest toward the field of geysers, hot springs, mud pots, and mage stones. Chapter 50 Fletcher and Merry.
You've never been to Melyncarrig, have you? Asked Fletcher. It wasn't a great place for me when I was a student.
I have, actually, said Merry. Damon brought me here when we came back from Ryas, before we gated to his private quarters in the Royal Palace in Brendinas. I didn't get to see much. We were only here for a few minutes.
That's still too long as far as I'm concerned, said Fletcher. I'm only here now for the good of the kingdom and to stick it to Vero.
Is there a particular reason you don't like him? Asked Merry.
Besides him stealing magestones and attacking us.
Yes, said Fletcher. It's a long story and not worth getting into. We have more important things to deal with.
Agreed, said Merry. How can I help?
Fletcher paused to lean on one of the kitchen work tables. Merry could see she was thinking, so she kept quiet.
Blast, said Fletcher. We need rope. I know Nud said he just received some in a shipment of supplies, but I forgot to ask him where he stored it.
Do you want me to use my ring to contact Einan? Asked Merry.
Then she remembered she'd loaned her ring to Dothan. Fletcher smiled at her.
I see you remember that's not an option.
Ah, well, said Merry. Let me help you search.
I wonder where Nud would store non-food items.
Things that aren't food? Asked Fletcher. They don't make rope soup in Applegarth.
What? Said Merry.
Rope soup? You're kidding.
Uh-huh, said Fletcher, grinning at Merry. Got you.
Merry looked at Fletcher and started laughing. It took her several seconds to stop.
What?
Asked Fletcher.
You made a joke, said Merry. I've never heard you joke before. You're always so serious about my magestone and setting, about my training, about Damon and Nud and now Vero. It's nice to know you have a sense of humour.
Am I really that bad? Asked Fletcher.
Merry stared at her.
All right, maybe I have been, Fletcher continued. Sorry.
It was a good joke, said Merry. Even better because it was unexpected. It won't be such a shock the next time.
If there is a next time, said Fletcher. I have a quota, and I'm only allowed to tell one every 20 years.
There you go, said Merry. You've told another one. A joke by exaggeration.
I guess I did, said Fletcher, smiling.
Then her serious mask returned.
Enough of that, she said. We need Nud's rope.
Do you start with a chicken or a beef stock? Asked Merry.
Either one will do, said Fletcher. You just need to let it simmer in a cookpot for 7 or 8 days until it's tender. If you don't, it gets stringy.
Ouch, said Merry. That's even worse, which means better.
She stopped to laugh again, then decided to add to the recipe. I'd toss in spring onions for extra flavour. And chopped garlic cloves, said Fircher. The two women were smiling and making faces at each other. And a braised rabbit, said Mary, feeding Fircher a straight line. No, not a rabbit, said Fircher. Mary grinned. Why not? Fircher started, but they both completed, because no one likes finding a hare in their soup. Mary hugged Fircher as they both moved from guffaws to plain laughing to giggles. After a minute, Fircher put Mary at arm's length and leaned back against the kitchen work table.
Thank you. I needed that, said Fircher.
We both did, said Mary. I haven't heard that joke since my father told it to Salda and me when we were small.
I heard it from my mother, said Fircher. My father went in for lectures, not funny stories.
Fircher's face brightened. Our humorous diversion was just what I needed to remember where Nud was likely to store the rope, she said.
Where?
Asked Mary. In the castle's laundry, Fircher replied. You always need lots of rope for clothes to dry on out here.
Why not dry it with wizardry? Asked Mary.
That stopped back when the academy was more active, said Fircher. An apprentice was put in charge of drying clothes with wizardry, and instead, the undergarments for every man and woman in Melin Carrick were turned to a fine grey ash by an overzealous application of heat.
Mary laughed again. It felt good to be laughing, as much as she had when she'd been travelling down the river with Einan.
Let me guess, said Mary. It was Hiblig. He seems to carry a perpetual chip on his shoulder.
No, said Fircher. Wizards from Gwynedd's faction don't train here. They have their own school built on swampland along the first big river, south of the Moravan. You could inhale a quart of mosquitoes in a single breath there if you didn't keep your shields up.
Why don't they drain the swamp and make it a better place to live? Asked Mary.
My Da drains more swampland across the Ruthra every season, with help from Dothan.
Your father is a wise and practical man, said Fircher. The wizards in Gwynedd's faction aren't. They take after their patron.
I see, said Mary.
All the more reason for us to win, then.
Correct, said Fircher.
Time to visit the laundry. Can you tie a tautline hitch? Asked Fircher. She was on her flying disc, floating near the rough bark of a sizable spear pine, a tree that grew perfectly straight and only retained branches on the upper third of its trunk. This specimen was 60 feet tall, and Mary was floating halfway up its length, guiding her flying disc above the floor of a broad valley. She was wrapping one end of the long rope they'd found around the tree's 2-yard circumference.
I can, and I have, said Mary. We can tighten it when I fasten the other end.
Far in the distance, they could hear the sounds of a herd of large herbivores grazing at the other end of the valley. It was still dark as a mineshaft in the middle hours of the night, but Fircher and Mary each had glowing spheres floating above their heads that provided sufficient illumination for the two wizards to accomplish what was necessary. Mary let the dangling rope coiled on her flying disc pay out behind her as she and Fircher headed for a second stand of spear pines on the far side of the valley. The rope was covered in powdered mage stones. It glittered in the light from their glow spheres. Fircher had found a small bag of mage stone shards in the Academy's artifact studio. It was enough to coat the rope, but not enough for the rest of the gate.
We were lucky to find 2 crocks full of waterproof glue in the laundry near the rope, said Fircher.
They were huge crocs, said Mary. It looked like Nud made the glue himself, too.
When you hunt wizards, you get a lot of horns and bones. It's easier to make big batches, said Fircher.
Why would he need so much glue? Asked Mary.
I'm not sure, said Fircher, given Daemon's odd whims and strange projects. But my memory is that it helps keep canvas waterproof. I remember getting lots of bad weather in Melin Carrig, so it would be useful.
I remember making glue outside in a cauldron with my mother back at Applegarth, said Mary. We'd boil out the gelatin, add spoiled milk, and include oil of wintergreen so it wouldn't smell so bad.
Wintergreen glue sounds intriguing, said Fircher. You've got a wise mother.
She has her good points, admitted Mary.
Once you tie off the other end of the rope, there's not much we can do until Nud and Einan come back.
You could teach me how to make wide gates, suggested Mary.
They'd reached the spear pine they'd selected on the opposite side of the valley, more than 100 yards away.
Nud had ordered a full spool of rope, so it was just enough to reach. Merry tied another taut-line hitch and tightened it as Fircher watched her.
"I could do that," said the older wizard. "It's the same general principle as making smaller gates."
"But you haven't taught me anything about making gates yet," said Merry.
"Oh, you're right. What kind of mentor am I?" said Fircher. "We'll remedy that lag right now. Let's descend and I'll show you."
"Great," said Merry.
She circled down in exuberant spirals to land next to Fircher. The two wizards moved their flying discs to their backs and found a pair of convenient rocks to sit on a few feet beyond the spear pine.
"There are three kinds of gates," Fircher began. "Standard gates, wide gates, and emergency gates. They all open congruencies, connecting one place with another."
Merry nodded and leaned forward.
"Standard gates," Fircher continued, "are powered by magical energy from their creators. They remain in effect as long as the wizard who made them lives. They're usually circles, squares, or rectangles, with magical anchors at the corners or at cardinal points for circles and sometimes ellipses. You can use those, too."
"You'll show me how to set those anchors?" asked Merry.
"After I finish explaining things," said Fircher, "and if we have time."
"The wizard who creates the gate can set it to be always open, locked, or only locked in one direction."
"I can see why the ability to lock gates is essential," said Merry. "Go on. Do you need to have wizards at both ends of a standard gate?"
"No," Fircher answered. "That's only required for wide gates, but it is possible. If two wizards create a standard gate, it breaks when one of them dies. I've done my share of re-establishing gates when their creators are gone. It's young wizards' work."
"Don't young wizards tend to die in battle?" asked Merry.
"They haven't for a generation," Fircher answered, "though that may change in the morning."
"Yes, it might," said Merry.
She shook her head slowly.
"Wizards need to touch the four anchor points at both ends and power the gates with their mage stones," said Fircher. "The directional and locking settings are added afterward."
"I can't wait to learn," said Merry.
"Wide gates need a continuous circuit of magical energy from powdered mage stones to keep them operating," said Fircher. "It takes at least two wizards on both sides of the gate to power one up, though four would be even better. When we get more powdered mage stone, we'll paint the tree trunks with glue, then coat them with the powder. Then we'll need to dig a trench between the trees and sprinkle more powder along its length, so the magical energy can flow all around the gate."
"Oh," said Merry, "we have to dig a trench. We need to get started, and we've got to bring shovels."
"Stop," teased Fircher. "Think."
"Oh," said Merry,
"that's right. I need to think like a wizard now. I guess it takes practice."
"Unless you are raised by wizards," said Fircher with a wan smile.
She nodded toward the space in the wide valley between the trees.
"Go ahead, young wizard. Show me."
"Let's see," said Merry.
She held her arms out wide, then brought them out in front of her with her fingers outstretched. Bright blue beams of tight light shot out from each hand and cut into the ground 6 inches apart. Fircher sent her glow sphere across to the far side of the valley so Merry could keep the path of her beams straight.
"Very good," said Fircher.
"Now flip it up so we can see the channel where we'll spread the powdered mage stones."
Merry concentrated. Using only blue tight light force beams from her left hand, she lifted her hand and turned it in a smooth, even motion. A triangular line of grass and soil extending across the valley flipped up, revealing a V-shaped hole that would be perfect for receiving powdered mage stone.
"Excellent," said Fircher. "Now you're thinking like a wizard."
Merry smiled and nodded her appreciation of Fircher's praise.
"Do wide gates have to be the same dimensions at either end?" she asked.
"Not exactly," said Fircher. "It can be a problem if they're off by yards, but a foot or two won't matter."
"That's why we need to reach Dothan, to tell him the dimensions of our gate."
"Correct," said Fircher.
"They have more flexibility at their end, since they'll be using logs, not trees, for uprights."
"Got it," said Merry.
"What about emergency gates?"
"Those are different, sort of," said Fircher.
They require only one set of anchor points, but the connection to the destination location has to be very strong.
Like my connection to Applegarth? Asked Mary.
No, not an emotional connection. A place where the wizard has spent a lot of time investing energy.